Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of Epic. And I'm joined by basically all of my friends and colleagues in the North Coast Environmental Movement right now. We have Caroline Griffith, Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Caroline.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Colin Fisk, Executive Director of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities. Hey, Colin.
Hello, Tom.
Matt Simmons, staff attorney at Epic and also a co-founder of the Redwood Coalition for Climate and Environmental Responsibility, or ROCR. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom.
And that's it. We're missing some of my favorite people. But here, a core group of them. So we're talking today about the Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA. So I'm sure that we'll say IRA ad nauseum throughout the course of this episode. So just very beginning to establish IRA equals Inflation Reduction Act. All right. So the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, this is the culmination of many months of negotiations within the Democratic caucus in the federal legislature about some sort of a climate package. This is what was left of Joe Biden's Build Back Better agenda. And it is the sister, the complement to all of the infrastructure spending that previously went through. So we're looking at hundreds of billions of dollars here, and this is actually going to pay for itself, and actually more than pay for itself. It is in theory going to result in national debt reduction through things like better enforcement, IRS. So making sure scofflaws actually pay their taxes appropriately and closing tax loopholes. So no real substantial tax increases as a result of this. Pretty exciting stuff. Let's break down what is in the bill and what this might mean for the North Coast of California. Matt, briefly, did I do an okay job describing largely the structure of the IRA, or how would you perhaps describe the bill generally?
Yeah, I think you did a pretty good job. It's a big spending bill, right? Because it's one of these, the ones where they need 50 votes instead of 60 votes because all they're doing is spending money, which has never made any sense to me as a rule, but we could talk about that later. It's a lot of money spent on climate-related things, and then it's also some money spent on healthcare and some money spent on beefing up the IRS so that they can make rich people pay their taxes and hopefully pay for all the money that we're spending.
All right. So it is going to a variety of different climate related actions. In every Democratic press release that you'll see about the IRA, they will champion this is the largest climate spending bill ever to have made it through Congress. So on one hand, that's fantastic. On the other hand, it's not going to be enough, right, to meet the scale and severity of the problem, to meet the timeliness that we need to address the problem by. This is a good first step, perhaps, but not a complete solution to this problem. And there are also within it some things which are the product of legislative deal making in Congress that will work against our climate goals by increasing oil and gas production here in the United States. Colin,
yeah,
what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the best way that I've heard this framed is that this bill, which is about to be signed into law, probably will be by the time this comes out, it puts us within reach of making those greenhouse gas reduction targets that scientifically we know we need to. It doesn't actually get us there, but I think a lot of folks were up to a couple of weeks ago sort of staring into the abyss of we're not going to have any federal climate action whatsoever, and we're way out of reach of meeting those targets. So I think that's sort of the broad framing of the implications of the bill. There's been a lot of, I would say, fairly well-respected groups that have modeled the impacts, and they all sort of come down to it's going to get us far enough towards those reduction targets that we could, with additional action, get there, but it's certainly not the end of the road.
Well, I think that that is a very important piece of it right there. This has not been without controversy, and there are definitely some climate groups and environmental justice groups who are pretty upset about this bill. But I would say that, yes, this is the best climate bill that we have ever had so far, and it needs to go further. And so I think the risk would be that folks would just say, just dust their hands off and be like, well, we did it and this is it, versus seeing this as a step in the direction that we need to go. And it's really, there was a complicated political calculus that had to happen to make this, to get this to this point. And I think that a lot of the controversy here is about compromises, which had to happen in order to move this forward, which is all very political, right? It has to do with who we have in those particular offices, the midterm elections coming up, and the idea that this might be the last opportunity to get something like this moving forward.
I will bring it back locally and talk about one provision of the bill that is certainly going to impact us here on the North Coast. And I think also speaks to the compromises issue and the fact that this bill does significantly advance the ball on getting renewable energy in place. So this is related to provisions for offshore wind. So we have new incentives within the bill for offshore wind energy development, primarily in the form of tax credits for offshore wind production, but we also have tax credits for other associated activities with offshore wind production. So if you're building a tugboat, say, for tugging out these massive offshore wind turbines, you also get tax credit for that. And it also continues to direct and actually furthers the direction for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management to release offshore wind areas. So one of the things that happened during the Trump administration was that Trump actually took areas offline. So large parts of the Southeast, Florida through the Carolinas, Georgia, were taken offline for offshore wind energy development. This bill has restored those areas. For BOEM, though, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, they're not just directed to do offshore wind. BOEM also does offshore oil leases. And here's where the bill gets complicated, is that it sets targets that if BOEM doesn't accomplish those for offshore oil leases, then it can't release new leases for offshore wind energy. So here's that conundrum. Here's that issue that we are talking about with the compromise and the deal making necessary to get 50 Democratic senators from diverse places like West Virginia and California to arrive together on one piece of legislation. I am still encouraged that overall this is going to be a net benefit to our nascent offshore wind energy industry locally. It's going to provide necessary measures to make these projects more cost competitive. And I think overall, we're going to see a benefit. But again, we are seeing direction as well for traditional fossil fuel infrastructure. Anybody want to add parts on top of this? I think that there's also provisions related to energy storage and transmission.
Yeah, I can jump in. It's hard to talk about a bill this big because there's just so much in it, but I'll try to give like my high level view of what is in this bill. It's a ton of money for offshore wind and solar in the form of tax credits. It's a ton of money for nuclear, geothermal in the form of tax credits. It's a ton of money going to the sort of demand side of electricity, right? So there's tax credits for heat pumps, tax credits for weatherizing your home so that your home uses electricity. And a lot of that actually goes to like regular people, which is really great. It's not just tax credits for like big corporations. It's like Tom wants to buy a new heat pump and he gets $2,000 to do it, which is good. And then it's a lot of money for federal agencies to conduct NEPA in order to get these energy projects. And I'm saying energy projects because it's both things like offshore wind and solar, but also new fracking and new offshore oil online quicker, right? With quicker and more paid for environmental review. It's going to streamline several existing energy projects that have been locked up in litigation for a long time, right? So like the one that I've heard the most about is, I think, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, Mountain Home Pipeline. I'm sorry, I'm not from West Virginia, so I don't know the exact name. That is a project that people have been fighting for a long, long time. And this bill gives it like a big thumbs up and hurries it through the process, which I can only imagine if I was one of the people locally who'd been fighting for this project, to have it approved as part of some big national deal would just be devastating. There's also funding in here for environmental justice communities. Some of that is work for like job guarantees for workers who are going to get laid off as we shift from like coal to other forms of energy, and then also health impact money. But it's not nearly as much money as Biden wanted to put in like his initially proposed Build Back Better bill. And so, again, if I was a member of one of those communities and I saw the amount of money earmarked for like my health just terribly slashed through this negotiation and compromise, I would be pretty pissed off, I think, rightfully. And so that's what you're hearing from all of us is like, I think we're happy about large portions of this bill, but it's not good enough. And a lot of things were left on the cutting room floor as it was getting written. Yeah.
Matt, I think you've covered a lot of ground there. I want to fill in one gap, which is near and dear to my heart, which is the transportation provisions. And just to say that because a very large chunk of the cost of the bill goes to electric vehicle rebates, basically. And I think that's an important measure for a couple of reasons. One is that the way that the current federal rebate law is written, a lot of the major manufacturers have run out of their rebates. And so you're not getting federal rebates if you buy those electric vehicles. This would reinstate those, but it would also add some complicated measures around trying to encourage the use of minerals and other manufacturing in the United States and allied countries for the production of those cars, which probably in the near term will limit how much money you'll actually effectively be able to get for an EV. Hopefully in the long term, I guess my sort of Pollyanna-ish hope is that it will encourage recycling of things like lithium domestically, because theoretically those are almost completely recyclable. And if we're going to have a sustainable EV industry, we're going to have to start doing that. But it does have some problems in the meantime. The bigger picture from the transportation perspective is that there's nothing at all about transit. There's nothing at all about walking or biking or anything. The only transportation issue, which bearing in mind transportation is our biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions, the only way that this bill tackles that is through the EV tax credits, really. And I would say that the modeling shows that of all the major sectors, this bill will do the least to reduce transportation emissions, even though hopefully it will help to accelerate that electrification and sort of zero emission transition of the fleet.
I could be wrong, but I think there's money in there to decarbonize public transit, right? Like buses and garbage
trucks. Yeah, there is. Yeah.
And the postal service, right. You know, like large government fleets.
So it's not just private vehicle owners that are going to be benefiting from that, which is good, right? Because, you know, people take the bus, people have garbage trucks drive by them, and we don't want those things emitting noxious fumes into everyone's air.
That's true. And I would say that one thing locally that will be important is that there are also major tax credits and other supports for the production of green hydrogen. For folks who are paying attention, the Humboldt Transit Authority is investing a lot, will be investing a lot in hydrogen buses because the existing battery electric buses don't have the range that they need for their regional routes. And so allowing some of the estimates that I saw would make green hydrogen, meaning made with renewable electricity from water instead of from fossil fuels, cheaper than the dirty stuff, theoretically. So that would be really huge if we could, here on the North Coast, if we can make sure that we are providing at a reasonable cost, actually zero emission buses and trucks and other heavy equipment that might need hydrogen as a fuel.
Caroline.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing up that point, Colin, that this doesn't do a whole lot to shift our systems and how we actually are using energy, right? That's one big thing that we can do with transportation is to shift to public transportation versus private vehicles. And this doesn't really focus too much on that, nor in any other way. A lot of what it does is just provide alternative energy sources for business as usual in many ways, which is good. We do absolutely need that. But it doesn't really, we're not thinking locally or globally about how we use resources and how we can shift how we use those resources and why we're using those resources. And when it comes to electric vehicles, one of the things that I've been analyzing this and thinking about the electric vehicle, the limitations of that tax credit, one thing that I'm reading in between the lines, because there is this provision that 40%, in order to receive the credit, 40% of the components of the vehicle need to be made or mined in the U.S. or countries with which we have trade agreements. And so that currently China is dominating the lithium market. What I worry about is that this will shift us towards more lithium mining here, which on the one hand, like, we need to be able to see the impacts of what we're doing. But on the other hand, this primarily is happening on indigenous lands. And we currently only have one active lithium mine in the United States. And there's one that folks have been fighting for the last few years in Thacker Pass in Nevada, that if there's more of a push to mine lithium in the United States, then we have to go through that complicated calculus, too, of on whose doorstep does this happen, which is a lot of what the environmental justice criticism is of this, is that we're still like, yes, we are doing great things to decarbonize a lot of our systems, but there are still sacrifice zones that exist. And those do still tend to be people of color and low-income communities.
The Eco News Report, and we're talking about the Inflation Reduction Act.
Totally agree with that, Caroline. And I think that both underlines the importance of the strategies that this bill doesn't address to shift people away from driving so much and the need to produce so many cars of whatever kind. But it also highlights the need for us as an environmental movement to the extent that we are going to need a lot of battery electric vehicles, which we are, to fight for that to be a clean and responsible recycling-based industry and not a big open-pit mining-based industry.
So something that's concerning perhaps for long-term EPIC members who have followed our work on national forest land reform is the amount of money that is going to subsidize logging on our national forests. It is euphemistically going to fuels reduction projects, although I think that we have seen too many things that are titled fuels reduction projects that are effectively just status quo logging projects. So this is another disappointing area, and this is, I think, just a general shortcoming both in national and statewide Democratic politics, is that the timber industry has some sort of a capture on the Democratic Party that I think is almost somewhat unexplainable. Or perhaps our fears of another paradise kind of event lead us to support policy outcomes that are well-intentioned, but ultimately backfire, no pun intended there. So again, continuing with the theme of, yeah, this is great. And also it kind of gives me a stomachache.
I will say another thing I like about this bill. I'm trying to be positive, guys.
And then we can talk about why we should try to be positive, because I think that strategically there's a conversation to be had there.
So most of this bill is carrots, right? It's money for things.
Yeah.
Very, very few sticks. And I am a strong believer in sticks. I think the climate problem requires sticks. And there is one stick in this bill that has not gotten very much press coverage. And I actually think that the fact that it hasn't gotten very much press coverage is why it's still in this bill. But hopefully Biden signs it before this podcast airs and no one important listens to it. There is a methane fee in this bill. Right. So people have been talking about a carbon price for decades, right? Charging polluters when they emit emissions. We're not getting a carbon price because apparently that's like the third rail, but we are getting a methane fee. It's, here, I have it in front of me. It's $900 per ton, and then it increases to $1,200 per ton in 2025, and then $1,500 per ton in 2026. And methane is a very intense greenhouse gas. It's more potent than carbon, but then it also leaves the atmosphere quicker. And so if this price can influence greenhouse gas emitters to get rid of the carbon, I mean, sorry, get rid of the methane that they're emitting quickly, it will have like a quick impact on the climate, which is super important right now as we're all experiencing all these impacts. And so, yeah, I'm also sort of hoping this can be like a trial balloon for a future carbon price if we desperately need. Because if you know, by 2025, the world hasn't imploded because of this methane price, like maybe we can come back to it with a carbon price. Yeah, so that's another nice thing in this bill that I don't think people are talking about. And to get to what Caroline was saying about environmental justice communities, the methane emissions from big refineries is one of their biggest complaints, right? I remember growing up in Los Angeles, that was a huge thing, with they'd be burning off methane all the time and causing a lot of health impacts to people. And so putting a real price on that methane is going to hopefully be a benefit to those communities.
There's one other stick that I've read about in here, which I think is getting even less attention, which is that, and it's a smaller thing than the methane fee, but could have an impact locally perhaps, is that they are apparently reinstating a fee on some petroleum products to fund the Superfund site cleanups. And that's something that hasn't been in place, I think, since the 90s. So we have plenty of contaminated sites around here. Of course, a lot of them are involve petroleum. And so that's another potentially positive thing, adding a little bit to the price of those carbon-based fuels and also funding that much-needed cleanup.
So I want to get back to the messaging about this bill. And I think that you are seeing two schools of thought from folks who are supportive of climate action on this bill. You have some large groups like the Center for Biological Diversity who are very critical of the bill, that their first statement is one of criticism, and then perhaps they temper that criticism later. Then I think that you see a lot of kind of cheerleading from, well, obviously the Democratic Party, from other groups that are perhaps more mainstream that want to maintain better relationships with Democratic politicians. Where do people, does this matter? Does how we talk about this matter? And why I bring it up is that this passed on a 50-50 vote through the Senate. So we had Kamala Harris break the tie to get this through. We have elections coming up in the fall. The prospects for the Democratic Party have increased significantly in the past couple months, both with the overturning of Roe and the excitement of that voting bloc or a voting bloc to correct that outrage. And now we are having accomplishments from the Biden administration that are tangible. We have this bill. We have funding for increased veteran care. Should we be more vocally supportive of something like this with the idea that we should try to get folks to the polls to go and vote? Or do we need to continue to try to hold legislators accountable for the failings of this bill?
I'm not sure it's an either or thing. And I'm going to watch what I say here, representing a nonprofit that doesn't involve myself in politics. But I think, well, first of all, I think it's important that, as Matt was sort of alluding to earlier, it's important not to downplay the folks who have very serious concerns and frankly, we're kind of betrayed here, especially the frontline communities who are being impacted by a lot of the specific projects. I think it's also important that by some measures, if we didn't pass this bill, there would have been almost no way to envision us getting anywhere near our emissions reduction targets that we need to meet. So I think there's a lot of things in here to celebrate. There's also a lot of things that are frankly kind of awful. And I think we just should be clear-eyed about both of those things. And I guess a longer-term hope is that by having so many carrots and doling out so much money all over the country for clean energy-related transitions, that maybe this will, over the coming decade, change the politics so that we don't have to continue to negotiate with terrorists. I mean, Joe Manchin, you know, over these kinds of things in the future, and we don't have to make these kinds of terrible compromises all the time.
I will stick up for Joe Manchin here. At least he continued to move the ball forward. We have a significantly pared down bill than what we started with. But for somebody who's coming from overwhelmingly Trump country in West Virginia, I can appreciate him as an endangered species in the Democratic coalition. Kyrsten Sinema, however, well, again, I need to be careful what I say on the podcast about Kyrsten Sinema, but not a friend of pod, as they might say. Caroline, what are your thoughts about this subject?
Well, I think that the simple fact that this bill got to this point shows that there has been a shift in our leadership. I don't think it's a big enough shift. There's still obviously like fossil fuel companies and large corporations obviously still have a much larger seat at the table than the average person who is affected by this. And so that is obviously problematic. But the fact that it got to this point shows that we're taking this seriously to some extent. I think that I would be remiss to call to really think of this as like a solution, because I think that we have a tendency as humans to like look for some sort of silver bullet that's going to solve all these problems. And there isn't one of those. Like this is complex. It will require systems change and lots of different solutions. And so I think that I don't want to be too congratulatory about this, because then I think that it runs the risk of this seeming like a silver bullet that's going to solve all the problems. This is a step that needs to be followed by many other steps. And so to the extent that our messaging about it and our talking about it could motivate people to participate in electoral politics, I don't really trust in that. Just talking to so many, I engage in electoral politics and talking to a lot of people who don't, and they have very legit reasons why they don't. And this is one of them, is that they see this is a failing of representative democracy, in that they don't feel like they were represented in this decision.
I will say though, Caroline, and I think this is important not to forget, that the really great things that are in the bill, I think we can lay a lot of the credit for that to the climate movement that has sort of evolved over the last decade or so. And the bill wouldn't have happened, and certainly all the great things that are in it wouldn't be in it, if it weren't for the youth movement and all these other really very increasingly effective and progressive groups that rallied around it. And so certainly they didn't get everything they wanted. But the fact, I think we can't just look at this as what the powers that be decided to give us. This was, to the extent that it was a win, it was a major win for the movement. And so I think credit needs to be given where it's due there.
You know, I would agree with that, Colin. And I will say that I know that the Sunrise Movement has done, who was one of the groups that really pushed the original bill that this is based off of. They are doing a lot of organizing work around getting young climate activists to run for office. So I think that anything is an organizing opportunity, right? And sometimes disappointments are really good organizing opportunities too, where you can look and say, I would have liked this to have been better. How could we make it better and work towards that? So I appreciate that, Colin, and I hope that that's how that works out.
All right. Well, I hope that folks have come away with a better understanding of what the heck is in this massive Inflation Reduction Act bill and how it might affect us here on the north coast of California. I'm going to close. I will use my power as the moderator of this conversation to close on something that I think is cool about all of this. And it plays to the name, why it's the Inflation Reduction Act. So here's my pitch for why people who might not care that much about climate change should care about this bill, is that investment in renewable energy is one way to ensure that we are more protected from international volatility. We're more protected against inflation in the future, because you don't need to supply your power plant with some sort of a commodity like gas or coal or something like that.
Or your car,
right? Like so much of the last inflation was a result of Putin's war in Ukraine. To the extent that we achieve energy independence through renewable energy, the safer we are going to be to market volatility, and we can have a good functioning economy that is based on carbon-free electrons. So that's maybe people don't care about that, but that's that's if there's a good tie to the actual title of the Inflation Reduction Act, I think it's that we are safer from future economic events like the one that we are currently experiencing in the future because of a bill like this.
You took something that people actually deeply care about, like the price of gas, and you made it sound very boring.
There we go. Well, this has been the Eco News Report. Join us again on this time and channel for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.